Human prospectors sought ores in asteroids that were big enough for commercial mining. In their tiny vessels, they eagerly combed the asteroid belt for its riches. Wars were fought over those resources. Two generations of rock rats made their fortunes in the belt, or lost their lives. That is why, nearly a generation earlier, Stoner had created the artifact inside asteroid 67-046. A sign, a signal, a greeting from the stars. He had thought long and hard about how to announce his return to humankind's home. He wanted an unmistakable signpost, a signal that clearly told his fellow humans that there was an alien presence among them. Yet he knew that simply announcing his presence would be met by disbelief, fear, xenophobic hatred. So he created a work of art, deep inside the rocky asteroid 67-046. Using the alien technology that dwelt within him, Stoner created a mirror that reflected each onlooker's deepest desire. A combination of light sculpture and digital imagery, the artifact would scan each onlooker's brain and respond uniquely to that individual as he or she gazed upon it. Stoner placed it inside the asteroid, expecting that by the time humans reached that far into the belt, they might be ready for contact with alien intelligence. He was wrong. The artifact was a fiasco. The first humans to discover it were a family of prospectors, a married couple and their two young children who lived aboard their ship as they scouted through the belt for asteroids valuable enough to claim. They became so enthralled with what they saw in the artifact that they nearly starved to death. The glowing, alluring imagery was hypnotic, its effect on them stronger than any drug. Stoner saw to it that they were saved before they died in the womb-like chamber that he had hollowed out. He influenced a patrol vessel belonging to Humphrey's Space Systems to look into their refusal to answer regular check-in calls. Once they found the ragged, emaciated, and raptured family, they sent word back to the top levels of their corporation's management. Martin Humphreys himself soon came racing to see the artifact. Once he did, his exposure to his own inner self unhinged the solar system's wealthiest man. Humphreys suffered an emotional meltdown and was swiftly whisked to a private sanitarium on Earth. The asteroid was moved to a new, highly inclined orbit and guarded so that no one, not even Earth's scientists, could get to it. Stoner watched all this in shocked surprise and no little disgust. A message from the stars, he told himself, and they try to hide it. He thought about the other message that had existed in the solar system for at least a million years. The nanomachines that had created and maintained the brilliant, beautiful rings of Saturn. The solar system had been visited by intelligent aliens when the human race was just beginning to diverge from its apish, hominid ancestors. The aliens had built the spectacular rings around Saturn, believing that in time explorers would be drawn to them by curiosity and awe. The aliens were right. Humans eventually traveled to Saturn to study its rings. They learned that the rings harbored nanomachines, hardy little mechanisms the size of viruses that busily kept the rings intact and prevented them from collapsing into the giant planet Saturn's immense churning bulk, as they would have if not artificially maintained. Once humans discovered the nanomachines, the alien devices sent a signal pulsing through interstellar space, a signal announcing that a new intelligent species had been discovered. That signal was still expanding through the Milky Way galaxy, a sphere of energy that bore the information of that discovery. But there was no one left to receive the joyous news. The aliens who had created the rings were long gone from the solar system. Stoner knew that on their homeworld they had fallen into extinction thousands of years earlier. In his mind's eye, he saw their planet once again, a placid, peaceful world of green from pole to pole, except for the slowly decaying cities that held the dead like elaborate tombs, tended over the centuries by automated machines that were inevitably breaking down. Biological warfare had wiped out that intelligent race. The innocents, the aggressors, the would-be peacemakers, they had all died, down to the last one. The human race was heading toward its own deadly crisis at breakneck speed. Stoner knew he had to prevent them from destroying themselves. Dismayed, almost angry at his fellow humans' instinctive fear of contact with extraterrestrial intelligence, he at last realized that he had to make his presence unmistakably known. Determined to help the human race survive its own folly, almost in desperation, he announced his return to the solar system in a message he beamed to every major astronomical facility on Earth and the Moon, and received silence in return. He caused the northern and southern lights to glow and pulse night after night after night. Like turtles facing danger, humankind's leaders pulled in their heads and tried to ignore his signal. "I never thought it would be this difficult," he said to his wife aboard the safety of their starship. Jo shook her head wearily. "They're xenophobic, Keith. You knew that. Just look at how they treat each other. A slight difference in skin color or the shape of the eyes is enough to terrify them." "And what they fear," he admitted, "they try to destroy." Jo agreed. "Their first reaction is to lash out and attack what frightens them." Stoner's shoulders slumped. "And we're human, just like they are. Imagine what they'd do if real aliens confronted them."
"But we're not really human anymore, are we?"
Jo pointed out to him.
"They know that, no matter what visible form you take."
"We're trying to save them from extinction, and they busy themselves playing their paranoid games."
"That's who they are," said Jo. "That's what they are. Those traits have served them pretty well through the Ice Ages and the early phases of their civilization. They had to be tough, suspicious, wary of outsiders. Those were survival traits."
"But now those traits are counter-survival," Stoner said. "They've got to change." Jo smiled sadly.
"Good luck, darling. I hope you can make some headway with this Archbishop Overmeyer."
He saw that his wife's real concern was for her children, exploring the teeming, dangerous world of their origin. Kathy stood in the baking sunlight and stared at Hatshepsut's temple, wavering in the heat currents rising from the bare desert floor.
"You must realize," the woman tour guide was saying to her little group, "that Hatshepsut was a true ruler of ancient Egypt in the 18th dynasty. She was not a queen, not the wife of a king, but pharaoh in her own right."
"Nearly 3,500 years ago," Kathy said to herself as she squinted through the blazing sunshine at the shimmering temple. The tour guide held a parasol over her head, as did several of the tourists. Kathy was bareheaded, but protected by a shell of energy that enclosed her body. The little group proceeded along the roped-off walkway toward the tomb. Not a massive, looming pyramid like the tombs of the male kings, Kathy thought. Hatshepsut's temple was a masterpiece of architecture, terraced, colonnaded, graceful, its three-story structure blending with the bare cliffs behind it. They moved like a privileged little procession of royalty along the walkway, protected by a squad of private security guards who kept pace on either side, ahead and behind. The guards wore dark wraparound glasses laden with miniaturized sensors and carried machine pistols in their hands. "God knows what other weapons they've got under their coats," Kathy mused. Outside their perimeter was the crowd, milling, muttering, sullen-faced locals swathed in long robes and turbans. Vendors of wares, Kathy thought. Hawkers and hagglers, trying to make a living from the rich tourists, and maybe terrorists among them, maybe murderers and religious fanatics, and teenagers filled with hatred for the privileged, protected strangers who had come to gawk at their glorious past and ignore their destitute present. It wasn't until the tour was finished, and the sweaty, bedraggled tourists were getting back onto the air-conditioned bus, that the guide stopped Kathy. Most of the tourists were middle-aged or older. Kathy recognized English, Dutch, Japanese, and broad Australian accents among them. The guide was a black-skinned Egyptian, as young as Kathy's apparent age. Behind her, Kathy saw the security guards keeping the vendors and tradesmen at bay. "You are not a member of the tour," the guide said, glancing from Kathy's face to the checklist on her palm comp and back to Kathy again.
"No, I'm not," said Kathy in American English, smiling amiably. "I'm a guest."
The young woman frowned uncertainly, but then put on